Hello, this is If I Speak with me, Moya Lothie McLean. Unfortunately, Ash Sarkar, my partner in crime, could not be here today. So I'm delighted to introduce an If I Speak milestone, our very first guest who's now been promoted to co-host. She's a best-selling author, public intellectual, and presenter who reminds the girls that yes, you can both be glamorous and a committed socialist. Let me please welcome to the If I Speak studio... the wonderful Sean Fay.
Hi. What an introduction. And I am filling Ash's shoes, big shoes to fill. Not literally, she's a very petite lady.
Listeners, also, I should let you know that I'm slightly ill. I'm letting you know that not because you need to know, but because I have to tell everyone I meet that I am slightly ill while recording today's show. If I feel pain, you have to feel pain with me. So today's show, we will be tackling dilemmas, including what happens if you're a socialist, but you're also getting some of that sweet, sweet generational wealth. We'll also be talking about a big theory, which is going to be coming straight from our WhatsApp chats. But first, it is time for our traditional icebreaker, Vogue's 73 questions with 70 deducted. That's three questions, if you're following. So, Sean, what was the last meal you cooked for yourself?
Wow. I wrote a piece for Victuals last year explaining how I don't cook, and I had to provide a recipe in which I said Weetabix with milk was the recipe. The last meal I cooked for myself will have been in 2021. I think it would have been a HelloFresh stew. That was the last meal I cooked for myself 3 years ago.
That's incredible. What was the last meal you assembled for yourself? Was it Weetabix?
The last meal I assembled for myself. I mean, like, I guess if we're talking assembling, then it would be like a lasagna from Tesco.
That's fine.
Tastes the different. No, that's Sainsbury's, but whatever. Tesco Finest. Are we allowed to advertise?
Other supermarket brands are available.
Yeah.
Okay. Who's your problematic fave?
Oh, yeah. I don't like the term problematic fave because everyone's fucking problematic.
I'm actually perfect.
So with this question, the obvious answer I could say is like Azealia Banks, but everyone says Azealia Banks. If I was going to be like a little bit more highbrow, I would actually say I'm currently reading a lot of Philip Roth, and he's a real problematic fave because all of his male characters are like deep and reflective and tortured, like middle-aged men. And then like every woman character is called like pussy. And like has no characterization apart from the fact that she's blonde and like permanently up for it.
That's funny because obviously we've talked before about Christopher Nolan movies, given Oppenheimer recently won, swept the Oscars, and I actually bothered watching it afterwards, and I was shocked, let me tell you, shocked at the lack of characterization afforded to Kitty, which is a name very close to pussy. Kitty Oppenheimer's wife, she's just there to act as an archetype who drinks a bit and gets angry on his behalf. That's it. What was the last book you didn't finish?
This is the question that will get me not like cancelled, but like socially exiled. Honestly, there's no one I can't name that I probably won't bump into.
I'll talk about which book I didn't finish.
The trouble is, all the books that I finish are people that I don't know.
Don't name it. Just tell us why you didn't finish it.
Because it was really, really dry. I'm going to say this. Let me say this and I'll say no more. Left-wing political nonfiction writing, and I'm saying that as someone who does it, there's a lot of it that's very dry, and I feel like there's a little issue with people thinking that opaque language and making something actively difficult to read is a sign of seriousness and high intellect, and no, it's not. In fact, we have our responsibility as left-wing writers to communicate our ideas in a sort of dazzling, interesting, lively, vital way, and you know what? People don't do it, so I don't finish their books.
There is that tendency to go for this really, you know, dry, dense, almost pseudo-academic language.
Well, this goes to a larger point that I sometimes think that on the left, what people tend to do is that there is a sort of actual, it comes from a place of actual, I believe, actual pessimism about like any real success in terms of like winning bigger movements and power. And so people go into this quite like smug, internal, like you're just trying to impress your mates. And it's actually about making you all feel superior and clever, and actually not about trying to bring anyone along at all.
Before we go into a segment, I'm going to ask about you. So I know you're working on some stuff at the moment. Can you give us insights into what projects you're currently working on, the follow-up to your first best-selling book, The Transgender Issue?
Yes, I can. Thank you for this opportunity to self-promote. I am currently just finalizing my second book, which should be out. I can't say the exact month, but it should be like early 2025. So a little way off yet, but here's some pre-awareness. stay tuned for a pre-order link later this year, I'm sure. it's a book. It's another nonfiction book, but it's a bit more personal. If people have read my first book, this book is much more personal, and it's about, it uses my own love life as a jumping off point to talk about issues of like isolation, loneliness, and romance and heterosexuality in society as a whole, and particularly with like a particularly for millennial people, the fact that we sort of are existing at a time where a lot has changed about society in relation to romantic relationships, but a lot of our hopes and aspirations haven't changed, and how I feel caught in that, and I think how a lot of us feel caught. Is that a good elevator pitch?
That's an amazing elevator pitch. Where did the seed for this idea come from?
The seed, from an interesting question. I think the seed came from, like, I tend to over-intellectualize anything that's like emotionally difficult. So the transgender issue realistically was that I had transitioned in 4 years. I kind of thought all of the like fear and panic about being a trans person in the UK, I could somehow beat it by, which you can't, by the way, by acquiring as much knowledge about transphobia and political arguments around transness. And then in the end, I had all that knowledge, and then I was like, well, I need to do something with it. So I put it in a book. With this, it's just that I kept having like disastrous relationships and kept getting my heart broken. And then I was like, well, actually, this is now something that like really preoccupies me, because there's something here about my expectations and them coming up against reality again and again and again. And on a deep psychological level, it reaches into lots of aspects about my political identity, my aspirations, that like this is something that we don't tend to look at as like a serious political issue, our emotional lives. So I was like, let's write a book about that.
I think that leads on really nicely to what I want to talk about today, which is I've decided to parachute in a big theory segment. We haven't had a big theory segment in a while, but who else better to do it with than one of the foremost public intellectuals in the UK?
Where you're doing this, I feel like I'm being love bombed right now. If you were a man aged between 28 and 32 who like didn't have a job but was maybe considering a master's, I honestly now would be thinking we're in love.
All right, you're one of the foremost public intellectuals in my life. How about that? And this big theory is coming straight out of our WhatsApp chats.
Okay.
Which is... Gonna give the public and the listeners a little insight into the conversations we have.
All right.
Beyond sending each other TikToks all the time. So my big theory, and I have said this to you before, I think the 2024 is the start of an era of fantasy. And by that I mean, I think people are going to be talking about fantasy and the way we engage with fantasy a lot more. Obviously, this is because we're talking about it quite a lot, but I have seen more and more references to the fantasies we hold and either defenses of them or attempts to take them apart. And I mean this in both a cultural sense and in a political sense. So something that I've thought about quite a lot is J-Lo just released a bonkers movie about her life, and she talks a load about fantasy within that, and how her fantasies, her, you know, around love, people have said, no, maybe you have issues around, you know, your fantasies and relationships. She's like, no, I just love. Like, love's amazing. And then I see it also with stuff like the fantasy around couples like Travis Kelce and Taylor Swift, and this like romantic ideal that's being painted, and everyone's bought into this America's sweetheart, and the quarterback, who's not a quarterback, actually, he's a tight end, just so you know, I bought into it too. but there's all this other stuff happening politically where there's a real gap between what we're being told and the fantasies being put forward by, you know, political parties from all across the spectrum, and the reality we see every single day. I would even say there's fantasy involved in, you know, America's treatment of Israel and what it imagines Israel to be versus what it actually is. And I've been starting to think a lot more about how fantasy plays a role in our lives on the day to day. So let's start from this idea. Do you think that 2024 is the year of fantasy?
I guess, like, on that premise, I mean, it's not a new concern, right? I think, like, a long time ago, was an English literature student, and I actually think this, like, idea of fantasy certainly it's like there in the 18th century when the novel first emerges, and there's like a lot of like social concern and like not quite moral panic, but social concern about the rise of like women who read too many novels, like, and silly novels by lady novelists, and this idea that it might not be good for like a young lady to like immerse herself in the fantasy of this new form. And the novel was a pretty new form, which is like, you know, before there this long form prose, yeah, that centered particularly like once Jane Austen becomes really successful in England, like focuses on like, yeah, like the social world of women and their like romantic aspirations. So that has been like a recurring concern. I do think it's like on steroids now. I like when you were talking, I was thinking about a book I did finish recently, was Doppelganger by Naomi Klein. And she essentially says, particularly on the political front, a lot of what you say, she uses this idea of doubling and doppelgangers, and touches on like the difference between the right and the left in this age of disinformation. And she talks about, she calls it the mirror world, this idea of like, you know, conspiracy theorists that cross over, and it happened a lot in COVID, where they're living in a world where it's like, you know, unvaccinated people are the most oppressed group ever, and people who are vaccinated are shedding, and we've got to like get into schools. And she basically says that the central conflict now between, you know, people on the left and the liberals and people in the mirror, far right mirror world, is that we're both arguing about which one is living in a fantasy. Actually very similar, like as a trans person, it's very similar to like gender critical to feminists and trans people, is that like if you actually hear like a lot of trans exclusionary feminist arguments are basically like, Kathleen Stock, for example, will say, well, trans people are just living in an immersive, she would say, I'm living in an immersive fantasy, as if I'm like walking around being like lady with my lady feels, and everyone's like participating in the fantasy. And then I obviously think she's participating in a fantasy in which like trans women, this tiny little group, are the real threat, rather than like every other thing that's going wrong politically in our world. So I do think this is like a time, and I think it, and I think the reason it's probably, yeah, on steroids, you talked about romantic fantasy. I mean, I think there is more scope for fantasy because we have less social conventions and rules around our romantic relationships than ever before. Like there's a lot of self-governance and self-determination for more people now, but that gives much more space for fantasy. It's not like, you know, there was perhaps this idea before that for women, for example, they might have a brief romantic fantasy and then they get married and then they're like, oh, it's drudgery for the next 40 years. And that must have been a real come down. But now, like more and more women, for example, don't have to get married, and then you pretty much can't get out of it. But what probably, you know, like I'm talking because you mentioned our voice notes, like what we might think as women, who date men and so participate in heterosexual dynamics, is we might have still this fantasy of like what romantic relationships with men will give us that are like have been fed to us culturally, but we're finding it really unsatisfying for the lives we actually live.
What I'm also interested in is something I've realized, I think of, is this fantasy is quite negative. I conceive of fantasy as a negative thing. And in the examples we've talked about, then fantasy is almost leveled as a pejorative, like you're living a fantasy, you know, you're living in a fantasy. But we have recently also spoken about Ursula Le Guin. I've just started reading Ursula Le Guin. I know that you are a fan of Ursula Le Guin, as any good leftist is. And her fantasy was a way to really explore political ideas and nuances with them, and open those horizons, and I would not say in a negative way at all. Like that sort of like classic sci-fi fantasy was a way to bust open the neurons and say, well, this is what a, you know, a anarchist society could look like. This is what a really socialist society could look like, et cetera, et cetera. But now fantasy seems to be something that's wholly like you're living in the clouds, like get back down to reality. What happened? Like, what's that shift? What do you make of that change from just like, this is a negative thing?
Oh, I mean, I think, I guess it's a question of degree, and the idea, I guess the accusation and the negative is that you're stuck in the fantasy. I guess the thing about fantasy, and actually there's a recent ContraPoints has just put out a video about Twilight fan fiction. I didn't watch it all, but she talks a little bit about fantasy in that, so I'm going to credit her with this idea because it's not something that I came up with so succinctly, although it is something I've thought about, is that fantasies aren't like, they're not like literal wishes that you wish something were so, whether that's sexual fantasy, romantic fantasy, or indeed political fantasy. It's usually about creating a fantasy in which you're emotional needs are met, and that can be deeply comforting. And it can be like fantasy can be a very safe way to explore what your emotional needs are. I don't think there's a problem with that. I think the problem is it can be deeply painful when you're confronted with the fact that your fantasy is a fantasy, and what is your reaction then? And I think a lot of people sometimes in sexual fantasy, definitely in romantic fantasy, and certainly in political fantasy, and you did mention, I think, I think there's a lot of that around Gaza and the projections onto people defending Palestinians at this time, is that when you come up against reality, there's almost like a defensiveness, and in some cases like a real aggression. Mm-hmm. And that's because if someone's challenging your fantasy and you're not able to psychologically deal with that without perhaps like lashing out and blaming them, that's a sign of some kind of dysfunction.
Is fantasy, you know, really on the agenda? Is it just something that we've been talking about and now I'm seeing it everywhere? You know, like how when you get a pet and suddenly you see that breed of pet all the time, or is that something that just happened to me? What's it called? Confirmation bias. Or is it something that is coming up as a topic again and again and again because of the social context having got so grim and the fantasies being so divorced that people are starting to really call it out and say, actually, maybe this is a fantasy?
I think, like I said at the beginning, I think it's always been there. I'm actually just thinking about, in the final two episodes of, the penultimate episode of Sex and the City, the series, Carrie says that she's going to Miranda, that she's going to live in Paris with Alexander Petrovsky, this Russian artist, and Miranda knows it's not a good idea, and she says, I'm gonna go to Paris and live my life, and Miranda's like, screams at her in the middle of the street, you're living in a fantasy. And there's an edit on YouTube where it's Miranda shouting, you're living in a fantasy, for 10 minutes. And I sometimes just play that, but I just wanted to mention that. Look it up.
That's self-help everyone.
No, but the thing is that, like, you know, so that idea of it, I think there is a reason why. On a psychological level, and I have listened when I was prepared, like I write about fantasy a little bit in the book that you mentioned, the forthcoming book, and I looked, and there are psychological explanations for people that have dysfunctional levels of fantasy, which is something that, like, I certainly think I had when I was younger. And for me, it was often a way to displace the fact that there were certain, you know, like there are certain circumstances you feel you can't escape. So a fantasy can take you out of them. And, you know, on a psychological level, if you listen to therapists, a lot of them will suggest that if you're stuck or you're obsessing, say, about a crush, or you're obsessing about someone that you went on 3 dates with and you don't know them, that probably the origin of that is that something else is wrong in your life. You might be also dealing with chronic stress that might be right back to childhood if you really are someone that obsesses a lot. And I think if we look at that culturally, we have this bizarre... we're in this bizarre time where I do think, like, there's the overlay of the climate crisis and a sense of futility and a lack of futurity. There are horrible things happening in the world, and obviously there have always been horrible things happening in the world, but we consume them in a very immediate way that we're not psychologically equipped to deal with. I think a lot of people have talked about this. That doesn't mean that we turn away, but it does mean that we have to acknowledge that we have all of this tech that is designed to change our behavior and mine us for data, but it's also presenting us with an increasingly, like, horrific worldview, but also is encouraging us into a fantasy. And again, Naomi Klein talks about this doubling idea, is that we all have double doppelgangers online, where we're creating a fantasy self. Like, I mean, if you think about your dating app profile or whatever.
On pause.
mine's fully deleted, babe.
She's like 3 steps ahead of me.
Yeah, I'm going to meet someone on the tube.
Well, that's fantasy.
Yeah, literally. So I think there is a time where, we're living in a time the other word, I guess, that springs to mind is dissociation. It's very easy for us to dissociate. And again, I guess on the romantic relationships front, I do think tech has a big role to play in this. Tech alongside the shift in that, like, one of the things I'm interested in my work, and it comes up a lot on the Vogue column, actually, is that we haven't necessarily explicitly come to terms with the fact that, like, romantic relationships have changed. Like Esther Perel, for example, says this, over the last 100 years, like, friendship has changed a bit, but at a very slow rate. our work relationships have like just gotten deteriorated and it's a similar principle, but the biggest and faster shift has been in our romantic relationships, and we're not like equipped to deal with that. So we've inherited all of the previous fantasies. And I think my big sort of, I guess, overarching take on this, particularly with heterosexual dynamics, is that I do think, I heard you and Ash discuss on a previous episode where you talked about being a femcel, right? And you were saying about how men are not, the men you meet are not on a...
On
a level with you emotionally in terms of their emotional maturity. And what I was thinking about when I listened to that is that that is very true. And that's also my experience. But also, if we're going to turn the lens on women, I think I and a lot of women I know struggle with the fact that we are coming up against like a fantasy of who we're expecting men to be. And that's like something that we probably have to take responsibility for, because I feel like I've had to. It can be because... perhaps our grandmothers thought men are there to charm you at the beginning for the first few months. Then you get married. And then it's the fact that you've got social status as a mother and wife, and you've got financial security, and that's what you're provided. And now what we really want is like emotional security. And we want, I'm marrying my best friend. And you want someone to be like an emotional support. And I think
the village in one, as you said before.
And I guess I see a lot of disappointment, I guess, in dating, because I still think women are socialized to like look to men for that before we look within. Yeah. And I think it's a process of having to be like, I might have to look within.
I might have to change my fantasies. I might have to rewrite my script.
Yeah. Well, fantasy is a projection outward, isn't it? And it's like, well, can I give this to myself?
Another question I want to explore is, what is a dysfunctional level of fantasy? Like, when do we cross over from like, oh, this is a nice little daydream I'm having, into this is changing the course of my life and driving my desires in a way that is not healthy to me?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's whenever the fantasy is there to, is used, I think, recurringly to avoid reality and to avoid living in the present.
What is reality, though? How do we
decide? Because fantasy,
it?
Like, for example, look at like sexual fantasy, right? Mm. Like, sexual fantasy can be, in particular, a very safe way to explore certain desires. And most people, some of their sexual fantasies might be ones that they go that extra step to realize, and many that they will not. They will never realize, and they don't want to. If you actually presented them with like, "Let's do this," they'd be like, "No, no." I think the dysfunctional level of fantasy, right, is when it becomes a recurring way to avoid and detach from reality, because at some point, if you're sort of like enraptured with a fantasy, then your reality and your real life and your like ability to be in the present is going to corrupt you. And like, if you think about like, again, I guess when I think about the immersive fantasy of like online like conspiracy theorists and like transphobic conspiracy theorists, which is what they are, I think like, you know, I think I'm past the point of really calling them gender critical, but these people rot their own lives. You know, they get divorced, they talk about the fact their kids don't talk to them, you know. And it's the same whether it's trans women are like taking over and cis women are being pushed out, whether it's the Great Reset and we're going to a cashless society or whatever it is, or whether it's like any number of conspiracy theorists, the vaccines, whatever, is in the end, these people, I think the strongest lens to view it through is addiction. And I think with fantasy, I do think there's a hugely addictive nature to fantasy. And I think a lot of what we've been taught is romantic is in fact addiction, which is, so again, something I write about in the forthcoming book, to plug again, but also like, to me, you know, I write quite openly about being an addict in recovery. And I think it's not that uncommon to me, having like actually had like a kind of like bona fide A addiction that everyone, the medical profession, everyone recognizes, is it's not that dissimilar in some ways to the psychological mechanism. Might be a little less chaotic for those around me sometimes, but like, I can see how there's like an addictive pull. And and there are clearly people, in the same way that some people do it with gambling addiction is a fantasy. It's this time it's going to win. And why wouldn't people do that with dating or relationships? This person's going to fix me. This is amazing. They're the most amazing person I've ever met. That's Ariana Grande.
This Ariana Grande album, let me tell you, this girlie is not healing. This girlie is not healing. Let's just put it that way. The other question that I obviously had was, what is an objective reality though? Like, how do we draw that line? Because we keep saying, you know, fantasy versus reality, but I think if we talk to some of these people in the fantasies, they'd be like, but I am living in reality. You're living in the fantasy. And it's, who decides what's the touching grass out here?
Well, here's the thing, isn't it? I think the crux of like trying to stay present in reality is you have to accept the unbearable reality that like other people are different to you and other people think differently to you. And actually, you know, we were talking earlier about left-wing ideas, is that I think a lot, like my experience of the left and left-wing organizing is sometimes we can struggle to understand that other people, well, we see it, we've got like manifest evidence, we have a Tory government, but people can't quite fathom that like what messaging might work for you or what kind of way of that you've been brought along won't work for someone else. And so it's easier to project onto them. And when we're talking about fantasy, I think that's the crux of it, right? Is that what, when you are heartbroken over someone that you thought you got really excited about, but you didn't actually know, and then they sort of like break it off after 3 months or whatever, is those, that's why, and I say this a lot in my column, people say, oh, I dated this guy for 3 months and I'm heartbroken and I'm much more devastated than I was after my relationship of 6 years ended. And it's like, yes, because you knew that person, you knew that the relationship worked. Yeah, and like the relationship ended because you knew it wasn't functioning and that you knew that you needed to take that next step. Whereas what you're left with when it's someone you didn't know.
Handful of dreams.
Yeah, and what they were to you was a manifestation of your own psychology. Mm. And I think, I think the hardest thing about, it's not about living in an, I guess, in an objective reality. It's about recognizing there is a lot about other people we do not know and that we have to be more curious. I think like a lot of fantasy is shutting off our curiosity to self-soothe with our own, about other people. It's to self-soothe with our own. I mean, when I was writing the transgender issue, I tried to get as much as possible in the minds of trans folks, which like I don't necessarily think was the healthiest thing for me. But like, I do think it's a worthy exercise if you're writing a polemic, is like, what does my counterpart think? Because—
Rather than your double, your Wario.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Well, it's like bigotry, right, isn't it? Like most bigots actually have a fantasy of something that they're defending. They think they're defending their country. They think they're defending women. They think they're defending their religion. They don't think they're hateful, most of them. And so I guess it's, that doesn't excuse bigotry, but I think it's about trying to be like intellectually curious about the other party.
I think that leads me on nicely to the final thought I had when you were speaking, which is, do you think the rise of individualism under late stage capitalism, I'll just say the phrase, say the line, Bart. Do you think the rise of individualism has made it both fantasy more powerful to us, but also made it harder to confront? Because we don't have shared fantasy in the same way that I think maybe, you know, in previous eras where the left was stronger, it's almost like you had the shared fantasy that you could buy into and a shared ideology and a shared goal. And now everyone's fantasy is like, well, we're in libertarian age and everyone gets their own individual dreams and fantasies. And if you try and challenge it and say, this is fucking bonkers, or like, I don't think this is healthy for you, they're like, this is my path and this is the path I'm walking. That kind of vibe.
I think consumer capitalism has a big role to play, like particularly like us living in the UK, quite a secular society. I was actually watching Ash Sarkar and Aaron Bastani's Downstream on Religion, and one thing that they talk about in that is like, obviously there has been an erosion of like a huge lot of like community ritual and even like life milestones and coming together as a result of the erosion of a spiritual life. And what that has been replaced with is not only like secularism, like there's no higher being, but also like consumer capitalism, i.e. in order to make you spend money, we're going to sell you a fantasy, which has been on, like, started obviously, like, probably, you know, really with the advertising of the 1960s, but now is everywhere. And we live constantly, like, social media is constantly advertising, and we're providing data for advertising. Is consumer capitalism basically says, like, if you engage in this consumer practice and this consumer practice, you know, you're going to be gorgeous, you're going to be sexy, you're going to be hot, everyone's going to love you. And
scope it, capitalism.
And yeah, and I think Miss Eva Illou. The End of Love by Eva Illou is, I mean, I would guess we'd both recommend that.
I'm
going to call
it Eva Illowitz. I'm such a philistine.
I think it's Illou, but I don't know.
I think it's definitely Illou. She's like French.
But I think, consumer capitalism, you know, sells us a constant fantasy. And like that is individualist, right? It's the way that you fill the void inside is not through, I guess, some kind of, perhaps in the past, people had more sort of like either religious or spiritual, like an idea that the material world isn't all there is. And now we're told that a materialistic society is all there is. And so we're sort of like rabidly consuming in the face of like knowing that it's destroying our environment.
And our bank accounts.
Yeah, and that's in the pursuit of a fantasy. Mm. And what's that? Like, again, that goes back to my point that that's almost an addictive process, that we're sort of culturally addicted to a fantasy that we think that just money will buy. I mean...
Shall we solve some other people's problems?
Yeah.
Great.
Go for it.
Dilemma number one. This is from a listener, obviously. Are you a hypocrite if you're a socialist, in brackets, like I am, yet you're going to inherit land and wealth from your family? What should you do? Give it all away or use it as a resource for achieving social good through cooperatives, etc.? I mean, some of the cooperatives I know are fucking awful. I guess they are a social good. I will agree with that. What do you think?
Well, I mean, the question, like, am I a hypocrite, right? Like, you're not a hypocrite for, I don't know, like, having the, like, the advantage and the genuine privilege. Like, I mean, that's one context in which we can say it's genuine privilege. You're not, you know, Tony Benn was a member of the aristocracy. You're not, you're not a hypocrite. And I think that, like, self-punishment is not going to be, like, that helpful, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I think, like, excessive... I'm not a big believer in, like, excessive guilt for the advantages that people have, because that can become quite self-involved quite quickly.
And also undermines leftist movements.
Yeah. I guess the question here about... we know that... I don't know if this person is a millennial. I suspect they probably are. Is that, like, millennials are about to become the richest generation ever because...
When? What time?
Yeah, because... What day? Because their boomer parents are dying. But, of course, it's only some millennials. But that, like... that transfer of inherited wealth, like, it's quite funny. I remember, like, 3 years ago, the writer Rachel Connolly wrote a piece in The Guardian basically saying that there was this, like, uniform idea that all millennials are really hard up or whatever, but actually that's not true because some have, like, huge inheritances coming to them, and that's about to transfer because boomers are getting older. And so, yeah, so I think there are going to be a lot of millennials who, because millennials also aren't getting more right wing with age. So there will be probably lots of people with this issue, which is they know they've got a lot of money coming, but they've got these, like, left wing principles and left wing friends, and they feel all this guilt. Yeah, I mean, I guess you do. I guess you can think about, if you actually have a surplus of wealth and resources, like, how there's plenty of things that you could do with that, that, like, will be a benefit to a society where there's no social welfare or infrastructure. Like, get creative, defo.
I think about this a lot because I have a lot of fantasies about winning the lottery and what I would do with that money. And obviously when you're younger, it's stuff like, I'll learn to drive, I'll take my mom on holiday. And now it's things like, how can I buy several properties and sell them back to the community the way they do with, sort of like co-op association in Cornwall, and there's some other places that have been doing this where they'll buy houses from the council, do them up and then sell them back to the community, and just like people for like £1. And I think about this at loads because it's, how can I actually use money for good? Obviously billionaires don't think like this. They're just hoarding. So if your conscience still manages to stay intact when you get this money, I would have prepared for it beforehand. If you know it's coming, you need to think about, how can I invest this in a program where it will keep giving these returns rather than just like one dollop of money, give it to charity and then it's gone. I would think more about, how can I have a long-term thing that's going on? Try not to become a landlord, but is it something that you have, I don't know, a social housing association and you set that up and that becomes the way that you're reinvesting long-term in the community, that you do set up a co-op, you start a partner scheme where your money is the first big thing that goes in and everyone else is paying in, and then you will get money that comes out regularly. do look to the past, because when there was more capital and more of a sharing economy mindset, people did do these things. It's just in the last X amount of years that's become about buying houses and flipping them and renting them out at the highest price and getting a portfolio. So we have the models out there to do this. And I don't, again, I also want to say, I don't think you're a hypocrite. And I do think that idea comes from sometimes the purity politics that are preached, that come from resentment on the left. Because obviously when people get a lot of wealth and money and you don't possess that, there is a lot of resentment with that. I find this resentment tends to come most from the middle class rather than like the cash poor middle class people rather than like working class people.
Yeah, and I've never...
Which is really interesting. It's like the people are like, you've got slightly more money than me and your parents paid this off even though my parents paid this off and you're not a real leftist because of this. It tends to come from the people who have a little bit and don't have everything they want aspirationally.
Yeah, I've never really like... fucked with that like whole... when people have left-wing politics pointing to the fact that like they're not working class, because it's like, well, actually, realistically, we're going to need some people with some inherited wealth to, like, I don't know, have functioning social movements in this climate. And also, yeah, I mean, like, some amazing, you know, there are examples of housing co-ops and resources. That's the thing that I think, if you have like surplus wealth, you can you can potentially, you kind of talked about this, like, rather than a one-off donation of money, there's actually the ability to like build some kind of resources. And there's so many social causes that need something. Just pick a cause, any cause.
I mean, I would start with housing. I think housing is the most pressing thing that you personally could, if you have land and wealth, housing to me is the sphere that you should be looking at. Obviously, if there was a way to fix the NHS by just parachuting in money, we'd do it. But the NHS problem is more to do with actually resourcing rather than funding, I would say. Arts and culture, obviously, that's been massively stripped back. But things just like simple social services in your local community.
There's that rich lady that owns the LRB, right? And then like they all have quite... sorry, James Butler. They all have quite nice... they all have quite nice... No, pretty decent salaries for writing about books.
Yeah, they have great salaries.
Because she's just a rich lady with a lot of money.
Yeah, it's that kind of thing. And I would look also to your local community, and first and foremost, because trying to save the world in one go will not work, but trying to build a robust, localized space around you and help there will bring you more in the way of success, I would say, if that's your goal. Should we get to another dilemma? From the beginning, I had a terrible holiday with a girlfriend recently. I was upset with her behaviour towards me. She then stayed on, the holiday presumably, for an extra few days and went clubbing with a guy all night. He was a friend of hers, whom she has repeatedly called handsome and charming. She didn't message me all night, and I obviously would have appreciated a text to let me know she was thinking of me while she was with him. I just...
I'm desperate to know what this is.
Sorry, I'm not laughing. I'm shocked. I decided to break up with her, in brackets, over text, for two major reasons. One, for the fact she was ill-tempered with me during our trip together. And two, she then ignored me during her night out the day after I left. She has since replied to my message, writing that he was gay. And also apologised for... I'm so sorry to this listener. I'm taking this very seriously. And also apologised for her poor mood throughout the trip. Do you think she will ever forgive me for sending a rash breakup text? Because I do desperately want the relationship to work. Am I right to be upset about her failure to communicate? Is my immediate reaction to run away from the relationship understandable? Or is my lack of faith a huge red flag? Also, a related question. If I could please ask one more, you can. Your answer to this one is the most important to me. Oh, this is heartbreaking. How do you learn to trust someone? I find myself relating very much to a line from Albertine by Jacqueline Rose. Fulfilling, despite himself, the spirit of truth, which was his greatest torment, that you never know what the other person is up to when you're not there. With lots of affection, I love everything you do. A heartbroken holidayer.
This, that's so interesting, that Jacqueline Rose quote, because it's literally goes back to what we were talking about earlier about the fundamental, like, disturbing reality that we don't know what's going on with other people. Gosh, there's a lot there.
I'll sum up here. This person, who I'm presuming is a man, just from the fact that they were worried that their girlfriend was with a guy all night and that he thought he was straight. And so they've gone on holiday. They had a bad holiday. He left early and she stayed on and went out all night with a really handsome friend of hers. And she didn't contact him all night. And he basically doesn't trust her. So he broke up with her, even though she said the guy was gay. And his main question is, how do I trust someone?
Yeah, I mean, actually, I have quite a lot of empathy for this person because I really have historically had trust issues. Yeah, how do you trust someone? I mean, that's kind of, I guess like that, but let's answer that first. I mean, I think like, how do you fundamentally come to trust other people? I mean, I think it's an inside job, isn't it? Because it's like, you have to look at the reasons why you struggle with trust. And that like realistically might be something that goes back all the way to childhood. Because that to me sounds like a fear of abandonment and dread of abandonment.
Very anxious.
Yeah, which is like, fear of abandonment is often a childhood thing. Doesn't have to be that, you know, there could be a variety of reasons for it. But, you know, parents had a really traumatic divorce, someone that you were very close to died, you know, there can be many reasons. But what that can often do is set off like a chain reaction where, you know, whenever you're like love someone or you're attached to someone, you basically are like afraid that the minute that you sort of find someone that you like feel emotionally invested in, the clock starts ticking on like, am
when
I gonna be
betrayed?
Yeah, and I'm gonna be betrayed. And you can almost bring that reality about through your own kind of imagination. I mean, like, honestly, I would probably say with trust issues, that's something that you have to kind of get into the ring with it and kind of work on it in a relationship. It's not something that like you can go and take a pill to trust people. I do actually think this person might, on the trust front, might benefit from therapy, because you probably need someone. You can't bring, I don't think it's healthy to bring all your trust issues to a partner either, because that's an unfair expectation. If it's not reasonable, what would you say on that point about trusting someone?
Well, I actually want to start with whether they should get back with the person.
Okay.
Because they've said, do you think she'll ever forgive me sending a rash breakup text? She might forgive you, but I don't think you should get back together. I do not think you should get back together, because I think when you've had conflict in that sense that is so, you haven't been able to resolve it in a healthy way on either side, you know, she was pissed off with them. They went home early. And then she went out all night and partied with this person who was a friend, didn't communicate, whatever. I think a lot of this from the perspective of someone who doesn't trust and is just seeing bad signs everywhere. But I do not think it sounds like you at the moment like yourself enough and trust yourself and other people enough to be in a relationship where you could have the foundations to work on that. I do think you need to work on this alone. And I think once you've also broken the trust of a relationship by breaking up with someone angrily over text, as someone who has done this before, I don't think you should go back into that relationship.
Yeah, I mean, I think that to me really struck out, because I've been on both sides of that. I've had someone effectively like end a significant relationship by text, and I was not able to move forward in contact with that person.
I don't think you can come back from the trust on that side.
No.
On her side, she'll be like, you just ended this over text.
Yeah.
How do you build the trust on that?
Yeah, exactly. And I agree. I think on this point, the issue is, I think these people could easily patch it all up and
they
get
could
back
patch
together.
Up and it'll be a Frankenstein's monster of a relationship.
But the trouble is that the underlying issue has not disappeared. And in fact, what will happen after the like makeup conversation and sex
and the honeymoon
period. Is that like the same old doubts will creep back in, and there's actually, you know, like an even, it will just emerge again. It's going to be chronic and recurring. And yeah, I mean, I do think that this trust issue with this person that's asked the question, linking to my original answer, is that I think this person needs to look at their own internally, is that trust issues, it's the hardest thing to accept that trust issues are often, even when we've like been let down by people in the past, because a lot of people get trust issues. Again, something that comes up when people are writing to my column is my last partner cheated on me, so now I have trust issues. It's like, well, actually, unfortunately, that's not your current partner's problem. There's something there that you have to divorce your self-worth and value from what someone else did and recognize actually that, like, if someone cheats on you or whatever, that's to do with them. And with abandonment issues, I think it's why I say, mentioned about childhood stuff. The reason that this stuff gets fixed in childhood is because when people, usually adults, caregivers, whatever, abandon us, or we perceive that they've abandoned us in childhood, developmentally, we're not equipped to say that's because of them. Mm. We don't have those faculties. As a child, you're egocentric. You're like, well, I've done something wrong. And so that fear subconsciously is there. And also, this sounds a lot like, as someone that has sent really drastic texts that I regret, is that for me, I know that my nervous system gets like overactive, and I'm
so,
like,
anxious, yeah, so adrenaline,
yeah, and yeah, it's done and you've blown it up before you've even had a chance to think. And I've had friends say to me before, take a day, you don't have to respond now. And it's just the hardest thing in the world because of nervous system regulation. And so to me, I think it's worth this person doing some, taking the time out.
Yeah.
To do, I know it's going to be really hard because there'll be a lot of guilt about how things ended, but I think the kindest thing to do would be, you know, I mean, I guess that if I were in that position, I'd probably be like, look, I'm really sorry about how this ended, but I actually think it speaks to a bigger issue that I need to work on myself, and that's not about you.
I want to say on the trust, how do you trust someone? Because I've been thinking about this, and I recently interviewed someone for a public piece, so I feel like I can relay the anecdote. And they were telling me about how they used to demand from their partner that they told them all the time that they loved them and they needed to hear it every day, and they would say it so much, it caused so much, and they didn't like trust them, and they had all this fractiousness in their relationship because every day they had this void inside them, they needed to hear it, and they needed to know they weren't going to be abandoned. And they started doing therapy, and one day, and it was on Valentine's Day, so very significant, they thought, what if I don't demand from my partner today that I need, you know, that they do this stuff for me, or that I need to hear like every second that they love me? What if I just this one time say, like, to say to myself, it's okay, it's just one time, I'm not gonna ask this of them today. And they didn't. And it started from there. And they kept taking those little steps. When they got the urge, they'd had enough therapy to, I guess, do breathing or whatever it is. For me, it's breathing. It's like taking 10 deep breaths before I do something, thinking, if I really want to do this, I would do this later, I will send this later, I will ask this question later. And just creating a space for yourself where you have a buffer between the impulsive action you want to do, or the acting on the intrusive thought that you have, and taking that space and just being able to sit with it for just a few minutes more. And that makes all the difference. And that's how you build up the habit of starting to trust someone and let that space happen. Because after that, this person said that they were doing it more and more and more, and their partner started coming to them and independently telling them the things they want to hear. And they didn't need to hear it so much. They didn't need to hear, you know, all this reassurance, all this, because they could finally see what was actually in the relationship and the love and care that they were being given. And their partner was more also willing to come to them and meet them because they weren't being totally smothered, and they weren't having to try and fill the void of their own insecurity and trust issues. So it's a practice. It's like everything else. How do you learn to trust someone? You practice. I found building my friendships up really helpful with this. I talk about friendship all the time, but in romantic relationships, it's often the rawest part where we find like our, you know, our childhood traumas or pain or whatever coming out, because this is this one-on-one intense interpersonal relationship. Whereas friendships, because I think there's socially less like onus put on them, even though they are just as important, more important to me, and now in sort of healing yourself. So friendships can be a really good site to build up that trust in the first place, and practice trusting people around you, letting people care for you, letting people do things, trusting what people are saying, and also practicing communication and conflict resolution. So if you have issues with one of your friends, and you can talk about it in a way that I find often I was unable previously to talk about in relationships, but now it's this whole model of how I can communicate with people that I care about when I'm upset, or and like actually listen to what they're saying and not just have my narrative in my head of what this is and how I should react, and actually take in, okay, actually I'm going to reassess how I've read this situation. I'm listening to you. I trust you. I trust your intentions. I trust what you feel towards me, and I know you care about me. And yeah, your trust is really a practice that you have to do yourself, because there are going to be people out there who will break your trust, but you can't let them destroy your trust for everyone else.
Yeah. I mean, it's the difference between healthy interdependence and codependence, and some therapeutic approaches will describe it as like open system relationships versus closed system relationships. Like an open system relationship is like we are two parties and there's like almost like a channel or a flow between us, and that could be friends, separate work, you know, we can go, we can be apart and come back together. And closed system is like a closed loop of energy where it's like I need you to do this for me to be okay. I need you to be okay in the way that I want for me to be okay. And I have, and that's like an excessive form of emotional reliance. And like a lot of us don't really get taught what the difference is. And we, again, we're like a product of often our families. But yeah, like if you're going to be in that closed loop thing, that's why like you mentioned friendships. I think it's because also friendships provide you with a lot, like nourishing friendships can provide you with a lot of examples of healthy interdependence. Like even if this person was taken away from me, I would be okay. Because again, like one, the fact that someone is separate to you is one of the most disturbing things about romantic love of all, that like you actually don't know who you're sleeping next to. That's really freaky, but it's true. And also the fact that like you don't, you can, it's never that healthy if it's like I need you to be something other than you are for me to be okay. Which is like the hardest thing, because again, we're not taught that that's like the essence of like what healthy love or healthy relationships is. But you need it, because everyone's either going to break up with you or die. That's how all relationships end, break up or death.
And on that note, so listener, yes, you can learn trust, but I think you should in the first instance start that process on your own and not in tandem with this other person. Sean Fay, thank you so much for guest hosting If I Speak.
Thank you. I do feel like we were just talking on WhatsApp voice notes.
But this time I get to see your beautiful face. I'm love bombing again. Yeah, literally. Stop this. God, maybe I need some more therapy.
I'm going to put you up on Instagram. It's a hard launch after 3 weeks.
This has been If I Speak with me, Moya Lothie McLean, and guest host
Sean Fay.
If you like the show, I'm just going to ask it now. Please rate and review us on whatever platform you're listening to this on. We will be back probably next week. See you then.